whether having the profession of doctor, artist, engineer, philosopher, or being the guy or gal walking down the street, we all have an interest at least, and perhaps a fascination at best, of our bodies. Dr. Jonathan Reisman, an MD and naturalist, wrote The Unseen Body, giving us an in-depth focus on 15 body organs, fluids, and mechanisms that highlight the unified field of life, sharing perspective on culture, the natural world, and life itself. Join us. This is Robin with Tributaries. Jonathan, reading any one chapter in your book, The Unseen Body, which itemizes 15 organs or fluids in the body, is a literal cause for a pause. Was there any one chapter or body part in particular for you that sent you off into wonder more than any of the others?
Of course, every body part and bodily fluid is, you know, worthy of contemplation and has kind of its own little interesting things about it. Certainly when practicing medicine, treating diseases of all these different body parts and using bodily fluids to help diagnose and for other purposes. So you get to know them all very well. I suppose the throat was one in particular, which is the first chapter. I kind of liked thinking about the throat from the time we sort of first learned about it on an anatomical level to when it became more important when I was a practicing clinician years later. I think perhaps more than other body parts and bodily fluids, the throat did get me thinking quite a bit.
Now, you wrote that as a doctor and as a mycologist, observation only gets you so far to understand either the body or the fungi, and one must comprehend ecology. Would you give an example of what you mean regarding both the body and the earth?
Sure. So I think, for instance, in the world of ecology, on the very practical level of, let's say, gathering wild edible mushrooms, let me also say I don't consider myself a mycologist. That might have been a little bit of an exaggeration. I'm a very amateur mushroom lover, but I don't think my knowledge rises to the level of mycologist. But when you're looking for wild edible mushrooms, there's certain trees that they will grow under, certain species, because they grow off those roots and prefer growing off those roots, like some mushrooms here we have in the east, hen of the woods, like oak trees, and there's a lot of other associations. So when you're going to hunt mushrooms, you're looking down for mushrooms, but you can also be looking up at the leaves on the trees to see where you're going and know, based on your sort of knowledge of where mushrooms like to grow, know where you might find a particular species. So in a way, you're observing a plant in order to know about a fungus, because those two are intertwined in sort of an ecological sense. And the same is true of the body. Actually, very often doctors will look at one organ or one bodily fluid to diagnose a completely different one. For instance, in diagnosing diabetes, let's say it's often a urine test that suggests the diagnosis. But diabetes, especially type 1, is a failing of the pancreas, which has nothing to do with urine. Yet you're looking at the patient's urine, analyzing it, sending it to the lab for tests in order to know about a completely separate organ that seems unrelated, except, of course, they are related in that way, that the pancreas controls sugar and that sugar can end up in the urine. In similar ways, I diagnose heart failure by listening to people's lungs most often. I listen to their heart also, of course, but it's often the finding in the lungs that there's fluid in the lungs and even in their legs, like I push on their shin. And that tells me that the heart could be in failure because of extra fluid there. Or I'm listening with my ears to the lungs, I hear extra fluid there. It's telling me about the heart. So you're looking at one organ, one body part to know about another because you understand these ecological collections. One more quick example, whenever a doctor prescribes a medicine, you have to think about side effects, which often affect other organs. So you're prescribing a diuretic for someone's heart, you have to worry about its side effect on the kidneys. It's a separate organ, but you know their ecological relationship, and therefore you consider them connected in that way and have to think about them in concert.
And in doing so, it really brings you into a non-linear world. Obviously, when you have knowledge of medicine and you have knowledge of the workings of the body, you can see the A to B to C. But I can imagine that there were many aha moments through the ages where the non-linear crept in and brought about some wonderful change.
Absolutely. In medicine, there's a lot of linear stuff too, right? There's A causes B and B causes C, and therefore I can conclude that A is the cause of this disease, C. But when you start getting into the sort of more the subtler connections between body parts, how they relate to each other and how they sometimes fail in concert in disease, you do have to think in nonlinear ways. It's very much like an interconnected web, I think, is how I often picture it, in the same way that you might consider an interconnected natural environment with different kinds of species, even different kingdoms that are related in different ways. To find edible wild mushrooms that aren't going to kill you or to diagnose a disease, right, you sort of have to understand that background, that ecology, and how each organ relates to each other one in order really to diagnose and treat disease well.
Yes, and I also want to congratulate you on your book, The Unseen Body, because even though you dissected everything into separate chapters, it works. It has a flow to it.
Thank you very much for those words.
Yeah. I recently met an old school chiropractor who became a chiropractor at 48 years old, and you did not go right from high school to college to med school. I can only imagine how your experience served you and your patients as well by going into medical school a little bit later. How did you experience this?
Yeah, I do think that later does often give you some added perspective. Often me and some other people, many of my friends who had taken time off between college and med school, often had other careers or other jobs or studying something else in some other line of work. Because the practice of medicine is so multifaceted, you act like a calculator when you're looking at lab values, but you act like a human when you're talking to the patient and examining them and eliciting information from them that's not always so easy to elicit. You have to be, so there's sort of very human side, a very technical side, and I think almost any skill, honestly, or any area of knowledge can, I think, be useful in being a doctor. You know, even some of my knowledge of plants and animals have helped me diagnose certain diseases or certain rashes, things like that. So I really think having those outside interests is valuable, and which sort of highlights the American system of medical education, right? All of our doctors first get a bachelor's degree. So honestly, they're reading a lot of, I guess, Plato and studying all these other things that may or may not be useful for a practicing doctor. I mean, I'm actually thrilled I read Plato in college. I'm not sure it helped me be a better doctor, but I'm sure glad I did anyway. And I found that actually a lot of my friends, we gravitated toward each other. People who had other careers, were a little bit older, and had had some outside experience before they came to medical school.
Yes, no doubt. And what effect did working on cadavers have for you? Did the beauty and poetry in life take a back seat during this study? Or was there added value?
There's different phases to the dissection. You know, when you're standing next to the body and smelling the smells, mostly there's the smells of preservative. It's nothing, you know, it's not like rotting or anything.
Right.
But let's just say the smells are there. The texture, I wouldn't call it a pleasant experience, but I do think ruminating on some of the things you learned or on some of the body parts, even when you're looking at cartoon-ish diagrams and drawings of how the body works, how organs are shaped, where they're placed, et cetera, it really all kind of comes together, I think, and really, I found it very fascinating from the very beginning, knowing a lot about each individual part, and then also, of course, as we mentioned, how they relate together. There is a lot of debate in medical education about how necessary a true actual human cadaver dissection is. There's actually these days better and better simulation softwares.
Yes.
Computerized. And it is way better than it has been in the past. Just like with reading Plato, though, I'm really glad that I got the chance to
right.
dissect an actual human. I feel actually very fortunate for that. And I've seen it since, even with like medical patients undergoing an autopsy after they die, to figure out kind of what happened when it's not understood what happened, which is less and less common these days because we do so many more diagnostics and imaging and we sort of know what's going on as people die more than ever. Still, we do autopsies, and that's another experience to kind of see, you know, have that curtain, as I say in the book, the curtain pulled back on daily life to see what's actually going on inside the body. It's really a one-of-a-kind experience, and I feel very fortunate I got to see it.
Yeah, I don't know why, but this hearing you right now just made me think of an added value, perhaps as someone who's not going through medical school having the experience of the dissection or looking at cadavers. I don't know what other major it would serve, but I can imagine it could be very, very informative into a lot of different avenues in life.
Certainly. I think, I mean, besides just sort of the fascination, perhaps, which many people would love, you know, there's many healthcare related fields, physical therapy and sports related things, that athletics, et cetera, where it's useful to understand kind of how the body is shaped, how it's constructed, how it's held together, what the materials that hold it together actually sort of feel like in your hand, you know, engineering. I mean, I think it's a valuable area for them as well. And it's important to remember, of course, the first anatomists in the Western tradition, the ones who did the first dissections, were artists themselves.
Yes.
Renaissance Italy was the first time that sort of the taboo against cutting open the dead was sort of, the floodgate sort of opened, and suddenly you could do it without getting ostracized from society. And I think a lot of them were artists too, just trying to figure out what the body's made of. You know, I guess they were artists, but they were also scientists, philosophers, and I think the dissection of the human body is sort of could be satisfying in all those different ways.
Yeah, and certainly for engineers, I could see a value there as well. What do you think is the most widely held misconception about the body in the general population?
That's a great question. Well, as an ER doctor, I could say a very practical example. For instance, I see many patients and parents of patients with a nosebleed who think it's a problem with the brain, I would say. There's one issue there that some people think that there's a connection there. I mean, there can be after trauma, but nosebleeds have nothing to do with the brain in general, more to do with the nose. I guess there's like everyday little understandings like that. You know, I think back on all some of the silly things that I heard and repeated in high school about gum remaining in your elementary tract for 7 years, and you know, if you make a face and get hit on the back hard enough, your face will stay that way forever. And I wish I could go back to my high school self who didn't think those things were true, but wasn't totally sure.
Right. That sounds like third grade. I can see little boys.
In the ER, you know, you see people come in because they're scared because they don't know a particular thing. And of course,
sure.
I understand. I didn't know those things either before I went to medical school. You know, that a fever is not dangerous, or that the higher the number does not mean that it's a more severe infection, and things like everyday do not worry type of messages. I give those a lot to my patients. So I guess there's a long list of such.
Yeah, very, very helpful. And do you think there's a misconception about medicine that stands out within the medical community?
Within the medical community, actually, I do think that doctors sometimes, I feel like doctors sort of have this romantic notion of the history of medicine before technology, sort of using your hands, doing the physical exam. I mean, we still do the physical exam, of course. We just have the aid of like fantastic analyses of bodily fluids like blood and imaging that lets us look inside the body. And it's made some of the physical exam less necessary. Naturally. I mean, we probably overuse that imaging technology, but that's a separate discussion. I think doctors pine for the past of medicine in ways that I think like patients definitely, definitely do not. And I think that doctors, in a sense, have to sort of get over that, the obsession with the past, before we have the technology, and to sort of focus on using it judiciously. You know, there's studies, for instance, showing that a medical student who learns to do an ultrasound of the heart gets a more accurate picture of what's going on with the heart than the best cardiologist with a stethoscope, you know, and that after those medical students were trained for 2 days in this study and did better at diagnosing problems with the heart valves than like a master cardiologist with a stethoscope. So I feel like the future is beckoning and doctors are too, holding on to the romantic red tinted glasses view of the own past of their profession, have to let it go a little bit more than they do. I'm not saying get rid of the past. You know, sometimes the old medications are the good ones. The ones we've used for 60 years are better than the newfangled, more expensive, less known entities. So I'm definitely not saying the past is not worth continuing and learning from.
Looking back, is there a procedure or a medicine that you just really scratch your head at? Go, why did they think this was good? Or
I would say there's too many to list, but yes, there's very many that, medical history is littered with examples of treatments that we used and then abandoned and sometimes even then used again. Some treatments sort of come in and out of fashion as the medical literature sort of tries to figure out what works and what doesn't. It stumbles around a lot, retraces old paths, and, there's fads and trends that come and go, and, the latest cure-all that's just going to fix everything. And then, 10 years later, it's like, well, it works kind of good at this one thing, and it's definitely not a cure-all for everything.
I feel
like we go through these cycles, aided by sensationalist media, too, let me add.
Right, yes. There's certainly a time warp, isn't there, between what maybe is getting investigated and discovered in a lab and then coming in to everyday medical practice.
Right, and I would say one of the things that I find most shocking from going to med school is just how difficult it actually is to figure out like what works and what doesn't really with the human body. It's sort of 1,000 to 1 bad studies versus good studies. It's so easy to make a bad study, so hard to make a good study. So it's really just the ongoing process of groping in the darkness and trying to figure out what works and taking wrong turns. But one of the issues with research, yes, is making sure your research is designed well to apply to the real world, where people are human and forget and are too busy to do X, Y, and Z, or not interested in taking the extra time and effort it takes to do X, Y, Z. And so I think overcoming that distance or that difference or that barrier between the lab world and the real world is super important and not easy at all.
And then would you add in there the fact that pharmaceutical studies are in charge of doing a lot of the studies, and how honest or dishonest do you think they are?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a problem as well. There's so many problems with which studies get published and which don't. Certainly pharmaceuticals companies paying for their studies. I mean, it's good that they pay for their studies. Studies are very expensive, and the people who stand to profit from drugs should put the money into testing them for sure. But I mean, yeah, they have to be good studies. And there's, the publication bias where medical journals are sort of a sensationalist in a way too.
Yes.
Like the mainstream media, where you want to publish the blockbuster study. You don't want to publish the study that shows something doesn't work. It's always more, it's inherently naturally more exciting when something does work. So it's sort of like a lot of negative studies don't get published, and that can make people think certain drugs work better than they do.
Right.
So,
and
there's definitely so many barriers in this, and that is one of them, which you mentioned.
Yes. And yet every study that does not work certainly paves the next path or road or direction.
Right. It's super important that, like I said, medical history is just us groping around making wrong turns. I mean, you have to know when you make that wrong turn, and the sooner the better. We have sort of tangents that take decades to get off of sometimes with medical progress.
So, right. Yes.
I feel like we need almost an Operation Warp Speed just for medical research. We just need like almost a national effort to like figure out what the heck is going on with our bodies when they're sick, how to prevent disease and how to treat disease.
Right. At the end of the interview, I was going to ask you if you just were completely in your imagination, what would you want or what would you like to see developed for humans? And sounds like you've already answered that question.
Well, I certainly also think that a lot of a lot of what doctors do probably doesn't help and might hurt, or at least doesn't help much of it. And figuring out which of those things don't help is super important, I think. For instance, even just like certain infections we treat with IV antibiotics alone, sometimes for weeks. And everyone's for decades has been, I don't know if it's afraid, lack of funding, lack of interest to do a head-to-head with just orally taken antibiotics versus the IV, let's say for 6 weeks for a bone infection. And whenever they actually get around to doing those studies, the oral pills are always as good as IV. And, there's no issue. So it's kind of like in your head, you think, in the head of a doctor or anybody, you think, oh, IV is going to work, be stronger, going to work faster. It has to. It's right in the bloodstream. But then you study it and turns out, you know, that while that was a nice story, it actually doesn't make a difference. So I think a lot of what we do in that way where we think we're being more aggressive or we're choosing option treatment option B instead of A, are we actually helping? So I feel like just that, figuring out what we're doing that's helping and what we're doing that's not helping, is important. And I feel like we have to just be absolutely focused and militant on getting good evidence and not let anything cloud our judgment, whether it's glorification of the past of medicine or cost or politics or anything. We have to know what, it's really hard to understand reality, but we really need to know.
Yes, and this certainly feeds into medical issues and care for the aged. Some of the efforts are seemingly heroic, and yet end of life is end of life.
Definitely. Yeah, it's definitely an issue. I guess awareness of end of life issues, awareness of living wills, things like that. Certainly I've seen, even in my short medical career from the time I was in med school about a decade ago, I see so much more societal awareness of those issues, which is good. You know,
yes, yes.
I do think sometimes in the hospital, doctors can be too quick to say, oh, the prognosis is terrible, let's not bother trying. But obviously, the reverse happens also.
Yes.
Very often. And as a doctor, as a resident, you're the ones carrying out that brutal act on this poor dying person. So
right.
It's sort of not, I mean, you're in a better position than the patient, obviously, and you're not as emotionally attached as the family, but you're the one carrying out this heroic care on these, like, very fragile patients who have often declined for months or years due to some fatal illness. So there's definitely has to be a better way. You know, if you work in an ICU for any amount of time, you realize there has to be a better way. But I also think our medical technology and our medical knowledge and our medical know-how and abilities is sort of zoomed forward so quickly in the last century that it sort of far outstripped our ability to sort of think about, understand, rationalize, and moralize the questions that come up as a result. So it's sort of like our technology zoomed ahead of our morality.
Mm.
And I guess we need to try to catch up.
Good point, yes. What would you say is the greatest medical advancement?
Great question. Medical advancement. I guess I have to go with vaccines because as a medical student, I found the immune system to be the most kind of, I would say, amazing thing I learned about the body, probably. It most blew me away out of any other system that we learned about. And I almost felt like the fact that life exists at all in the universe, that
yes.
Step from no life to life as we know it is so amazing. And then the step from life to having something as complicated and as intelligent as the immune system almost felt like another step of equal magnitude towards, like, holy cow, this is so brilliant and wonderfully designed and intelligent. And I feel like the ability to figuring that out and then hacking it to work for us and to get rid of microbes that are killing us, I think is just really super brilliant again. So it's sort of like a hacking of the immune system vaccines that I just think are super brilliant and kind of the best way to deal with diseases. Just get rid of it altogether.
Is there anything in particular, beside obviously the medical training that you've received, that you draw on when it's 3 a.m. and a horrific accident victim comes through the doors of the ER?
Well, I would say, in a way, that situation is very standard in the ER. And I think to some extent, like in the moments that happens, I'm almost, I don't want to say robotic, but, you know, once you've been doing it for a few years, you are in a mode and you sort of know what to do. And you're sometimes without thinking so much.
Yes.
Because it's muscle memory. And also, I think, you know, I always find when the patient's there and you're working to stabilize them, let's say, or save them, that's not the emotional time, really, because you just met this person. You know nothing about them. Do they have family? I might not even know yet. Are they in the waiting room or do they have none? And it's sort of just almost like a technical challenge in front of you is how it feels sometimes. But when, depending how it turns out, how the patient does, if they live or if they die, and then, of course, once you meet the family and they come in, often can be like a punch in the face that this was a person. Obviously, you know it's a person, but sort of in the moment of making medical decisions, you're not always thinking about that side. But then afterwards, you get this punch in the face that, of course, it was a human. They had loved ones. You know, they lived their whole life up until this moment that you met them. And so then that's when I find to be the sort of tougher part.
Sure.
I mean, you have to find some way to deal with that side of the work.
Yes, I know everyone could find complaints about anything, but in particular, there are complaints about doctors and there are complaints about protocols and all of this. And yet, how far do we have to go before we really remember, oh, we're all doing the best we can? And it doesn't look like that when you're looking through emotion, but that's really a universal thing to remember, I think.
Absolutely. It is good to remember, especially when you're on the patient side of dealing with the healthcare system, I think, which can be very, very frustrating. For any doctor, I think it's super enlightening to be on that side to see how it works or fails to work often. But yes, remembering that your healthcare providers are doing the best they can,
yeah,
hopefully is a good message to yourself. Also, just stay calm because it can be incredibly frustrating.
Yes, and how do you decompress after an intense shift in the ER, or even perhaps just in an office all day? What's your go-to?
Yeah. Good question. I mean, I always sort of like getting out to nature, have hobbies, and my family, I think just getting away helps as well. Sometimes I wonder, I think I know some couples that are where they're both doctors, and I think in my view, it seems to lead to bringing work home too much. So I'm kind of glad my wife and I just have a little bit of overlap in our fields, enough to be interesting, but not enough to bring my work home. So that's good.
Oh, yeah, that does sound good. Well, the body is certainly more than the sum total of its parts. Does that present a challenge or a space for the unknown or spirit for you?
I certainly think it can. I guess for me personally, I'm not a spiritual or religious person, but I certainly do approach the body from appreciation, an awe at the sort of mystery and really the brilliance of the immune system, like I was talking about just recently, or really pick any body part or any bodily system or any bodily process. And there's clearly a genius to it. Whoever designed it, whatever designed it, what process, I don't know. And I guess I don't think about it often, but I certainly do enjoy recognizing how beautiful and brilliant it all seems to be designed. I mean, I guess I wrote my first book all about that.
Yeah. Well, the rabbit hole could take you forever on that one. So it's good that you got through medical school and became the doctor you are. Jonathan, thank you so much for speaking with us today, and congratulations on your book and the way you look at life. It's beautiful.
Pleasure to be here with you, Robin. Thank you.
Dr. Jonathan Reisman, author of The Unseen Body. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Our podcast can be found at the usual spots. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.